නමෝතස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ නමෝතස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ නමෝතස්සේ භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්සේ As you all can remember, we were discussing Alagaddupama Sutta, the simile of the snake. So actually this sutta has so many similes, and this is the 22nd sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and the reason to explain this sutta or the reason to preach this sutta by the Buddha is particularly a pernicious view happened in one of the monks' mind, and his name is Venerable Aritta, and he was very much like refusing or challenging one of the Buddha's teachings. So that Buddha's teaching is that Buddha has mentioned a certain way of behavior is very much like detrimental to one's spiritual life, and he has explained in various details with a lot of similes and examples about such kind of the danger in that such kind of a behavior. And this venerable monk is very much like denying that, telling that he know very well that what Buddha has mentioned, telling that those type of behaviors are detrimental, dangerous, but I understand they are not. So now certain other monks heard this view, the pernicious view that Venerable Aritta is having, and then they approach him and they try to explain very well using various similes what are the particularly the dangers of the sensual gratification, and that we already have discussed. And then still Venerable Aritta was not convinced, and he was unable to give up his wrong view. And then those monks came and informed the Buddha, and then Buddha summoned this Venerable Aritta, and then Buddha asked the same question, "Are you having this kind of a wrong view?" And then Venerable Aritta admitted that. And then actually the Buddha vehemently criticized him, because Buddha doesn't want to have a wrong view, have a wrong interpretation to his Dhamma. And he is explaining that that I have stated sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and despair, and that the danger in them is still more. So likewise Buddha is trying to explain him the real situation. And on the other hand, he further questioned the other monks to verify whether they are also having some wrong view. And then they mentioned that they agree with what Buddha has mentioned, and they heard that Buddha was telling several times that the sensual gratification is detrimental to the spiritual life. So they explained that to the Buddha, and Buddha admitted that, and Buddha was satisfied with that. And then he started explaining further that one of the interesting statement here, that without thinking various sensual desires, without occupying one's mind with sensual desires, without being deluded by various sensual pleasure related thoughts and the signs, marks, one can't associate kind of a sensual pleasure. So that's a kind of a statement, kind of a principle we need to understand. So if we are doing deliberate sensual gratification, so that means internally we are polluted, our minds are somewhat defiled, already certain amount of sensual desire related thoughts are going on, and a fair amount of fabrication has already happened and it may be continuing. And again, various different sensuality-related signs are fairly occupied the mind. And then Buddha takes the other simile, that is the simile of the snake, which is the topic of the sutta itself. And where Buddha mentioned sometimes people are learning the Dhamma, but they are not properly understanding their meaning, and they are not taking them to their heart and try to live according to them. Rather, they learn it just to win the debates and to criticize the others. So that is a wrong way of grasping the Dhamma. And he explained that is very much similar to catching a snake, poisonous snakes, by its tail or by its body, so that the snake may turn back and bite the person. So it is quite dangerous. On the other hand, Buddha mentioned if one is properly grasping the Dhamma, so that means he is learning the various different kinds of Dhamma, but with the proper attitude, proper intention. So that is to learn and to understand it and to get some guidance. And again, they are trying to live according to that Dhamma. And not for debating, not to criticize others. So that is not their intention. So then Buddha mentioned, it is very much like grasping a snake with the proper way. Because he may be using a cleft stick, and having done so, he may grasp it rightly by the neck, then it is not harmful. So likewise, Buddha mentioned, one needs to understand the Dhamma properly, and we have to take it the proper meaning, and we need to understand properly. And if we can't understand, Buddha again mentioned that you need to approach another person who is well-versed, well-educated, or well understood the Dhamma, and you need to abandon all your doubts by questioning him. So likewise, that has such kind of an effort has to be made in order to overcome various doubts. And further, Buddha mentioned, when you understand the meaning of my statements, remember it accordingly. And when you do not understand the meaning of my statements, then ask either me about it or those bhikkhus who are wise. So that means Buddha is actually emphasizing here that he intends everyone to have proper understanding and without giving wrong interpretation. And then again he is coming up with another very interesting simile, that is the simile of the raft, where he mentioned his dhamma is to cross over, go to the other shore, and not to hold it or grasp it. Now, here the simile is also very interesting, and one man saw a great expanse of water, and he understood that this side is dangerous and he need to cross to the other side, but he can't find a boat or bridge to cross. So he decided to build a raft. And that raft is built using various available material. It is not a really crafted, really professionally made raft. Rather, he is doing it from what is available. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches and leaves and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Now you can understand very much like how we are also learning the Dhamma, because we can't properly get what is exactly meant to the Nibbana, and here nowadays Buddha is not available, and we are trying this and that, and we are learning from here, learning from there, practicing here, practicing there. So various ways we are trying to build the raft, but ultimately the main idea is to use that raft to cross over, to go to the other shore. And once it is done, probably we can abandon the raft. So till that, we need to learn, we need to understand, we need to ponder, and we need to practice, and we need to verify our experience with the Buddha's teaching. And for that verification, from here and there, we are learning. Like that particular person collecting grass, twigs, branches, leaves from different places. So likewise, we are also supposed to make an effort to find this and that, find various suttas, find various Dhamma sermons, maybe finding the times of the retreat. So likewise, we have to make that effort. And later, while we are using the raft, so the raft alone can't drive. So we have to make another effort, that the person is using his own hands, his own legs. It is not that he is simply standing on the raft. It's a kind of a fairly effortful task. So he himself has to make an effort even though the raft is available now. So that means while practicing you have to have a kind of a continuous effort. The practice has to be continuous till we reach the other shore. So this continuous effort is a must. And then lastly Buddha mentioned here, so that person after going to the other shore, suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it onto my shoulder and then go wherever I show, when I want. So that is not the wrong idea. So that is not the wrong perspective he has to have related to the raft, because it is for, he has made it just to cross over, not to carry it by his own shoulder. So therefore Buddha mentioned, suppose I were to haul it onto the dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now that is the proper approach one has to take. So similarly Buddha mentioned, I have shown you the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Now here also we need to understand, till we cross over, we need to grasp, we need to understand, we need to learn, we need to practice. So everything, every effort has to be taken because we are still crossing. We haven't yet crossed over. And once we crossed over, that means when one becomes an arahant, so then Buddha mentioned, okay, now you can abandon even the Dhamma. When you know the Dhamma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even the teachings. How much more so things contrary to the teachings. So all the other mundane things, I have no need to talk about them. So they are definitely are to be abandoned. So this is what we already discussed, and then we are now coming to another area, standpoints for views. Now this sutta, as you know, the reason for Buddha to preach it is the wrong pernicious view that Venerable Aritta had. Now Buddha explaining more wrong views which are possible to be grasped. Now this is very much like, say one person already had a wrong view and he is trying to spread it, and he himself is drowned in it, and Buddha now trying to clear that. Now Buddha teach another different types of wrong views. There's a possibility that people might grasp, wrongly grasp. So I have summarized them in another here. So the 6 standpoints for views. Now this is called Dittithana. So 6 standpoints for views. Now based upon these standpoints, one can generate, one can formulate various different kinds of views. That's why very much like why they are called standpoints. Dittithana. Not merely the ditti, but the Dittithana. That means by associating this, there can be so many other views also. So this becomes very much like the standing point for a particular view. And around that, so there can be so many other views as well. So these are very much like the roots, the main branches of the view, wrong view. And on the other hand, if you can remember in the Sambhasava Sutta, Buddha similarly came up with 6 wrong views that one can have because of wrong thinking. And there he mentioned that these wrong views are like a thicket of thorn. It's like a desert. So much of perplexity is there in these wrong views. So sometimes when we are having kind of very mundane type of problems, ordinary kind of problems, then we may not be into we may not have enough time to think. Say for example, if you have a lot of economic problems, if you are going through a sickness, so that means you are fully occupied with that problem, and you don't have much time to think about various philosophical things. But on the other hand, when you are having some time, probably you may be practicing, and you start practicing, you start thinking, you start pondering, and you start developing certain amount of concentration. So likewise, the people who are fairly involved with the practice are fairly prone to wrong views. So this is the area, therefore, we need to be fairly careful, because we as practitioners can end up with wrong views. So that danger is there. So that's why we need to explore these kinds of suttas. We need to understand what are the kind of dangers available. What are the kinds of perils available? What are the kinds of wrong paths available? Misleading can happen. So therefore, if we know the Dhamma properly, if we have investigated thoroughly, then the chance of getting wrong is very less. And what we understood also, we need to verify again and again with the Buddha's teaching, and we have to participate in discussions, listen to Dhamma. So likewise, we have to constantly verify what we know also till we fully attain. And here Buddha starts with one thing. So he talks about an ordinary worldly person, untaught ordinary person, who has no regard of noble ones, and unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men, and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma. Now, that is where this particular person has no understanding about the Dhamma at all. And he is not associating the wise people either. So it's very much like he is going on his own types of things. And the very easy wrong view, he is simply regarding his body as belonging to him, and it is the body that he is, and it belongs to him. And this is I am. The body is I am. So it's very much like the commonly available wrong view. As I said before, even when people have no time to think about some philosophical things, this kind of a wrong view is very much embedded in them. And the society is fairly encouraged that. So that wrong view is well encouraged by the society. So people all recognize themselves with their names, and they consider their face, the body, as their identity. So that is what being captured to our passport, to our identity card, when we are writing a biodata. So what is our height, what is our color of the eyes, whatever it is. So all these things are representing the wrong view that this body belongs to me. This body is mine, and this body is I am. I am the body. So this is a very, in a way we can say, it's a deeply rooted wrong view. And we simply accept it without challenging, without any kind of a verification. We simply acknowledge it. We simply accept it. And the society, our children, our parents, our teachers, this whole society is constantly confirming that. Yes, you are this. You are this body. Why are you weak today? Why are you, ill today? Or are you feeling well? How are you doing today? Where did you go today? So all these fairly refer to the body. So whenever we are talking that, okay, I went to Colombo. Or I went to Australia. I went to Sri Lanka. So that basically indicate. So the body was taken, I mean, you have taken the body to an airport and then put it to an airplane, and then the airplane is crossing the ocean, and then ultimately the body reaches another country's airport. So now the body is in a different country. But I refer it as, okay, I went to Australia, I went to Sri Lanka, I went to Canada, whatever it is. So this is the way also that we have to communicate, otherwise others can't understand. But the problem is, so these communication, these kinds of references, ultimately become the reality. So we use all these for our easy reference, for easy communication, to communicate what we have done, all our activities to communicate, to represent with the other people. But unfortunately, it becomes so deeply accepted norm, and we never challenge it, and we think that is the reality. So that is it. That is the truth. So we don't think that it is a mere convention. We don't think that it's a mere a methodology to make our lives easier. Ultimately, it becomes the norm, the accepted reality, and we grasp it. And the moment that someone else is telling a different convention, then we are really troubled. So considering one's body as oneself is therefore one of the rooted, deeply rooted wrong view. And in the Sakkaya Ditti, that is one of the very early, or rather one of the strong personality view one may have. And then the second one, he regards feelings thus: this is mine, this I am, this is myself. This is the second wrong view, the feelings. So in the morning, say I had a kind of good exercise, and as a result of that, suppose you feel really refreshed, and you do a little jogging, and you went to a walk, and you feel really comfortable, and you are telling another person, yeah, today I am feeling wonderful, today I am really well, today I feel really comfortable. So all these refer that the feeling, how you feel today. And maybe on the opposite, say in the morning when you are getting up, you feel a little weaker, you feel a little worried, you feel you are in a kind of bad mood, a lot of troubles are coming to the mind. So then you are feeling, okay, I'm tired, I'm anxious, I'm worried, I'm not feeling well, so I'm sick, I need to consult a doctor. So now all these are dis-ease. That means the feeling is not good, not favorable. But we recognize the feeling as myself. So I am the feeling. So the feeling belongs to me. So, I mean, we need to communicate with the doctor using such kind of a language, otherwise he can't understand. But the problem is these feelings are changing. What was available in the morning is not going to be available in the evening. So likewise, things are constantly changing. But we constantly refer the feeling belongs to me, feeling as I am. And on top of that, we are trying to control it. We are trying to have the necessary feelings, or the pleasurable feelings as much as possible. We want them, we want to hold them, we want to keep them. And on the other hand, we want to get rid of the wrong or the bad, unfavorable kinds of suffering, the painful feelings. And we are quite ignorant about the equanimous feelings. So in terms of the feelings, again, we have this kind of a wrong perception, wrong view. And ultimately, we consider these feelings are me, myself, and that is how we having the wrong view. And then Buddha mentioned, he regards perception thus: this is mine, this I am, this is myself. Now, so that means, now he is going to the third aggregate, the perceptions, various signs. So, say for example, you are now learning at grade 8. So that is the grade given, that is the norm given, that is the kind of reference given. So I am now referring that. So I am in grade 8. My name is so and so. So my age is this. So I belong to this particular caste. I belong to this particular nationality. So I am learning in this particular school. Or assume that you already passed out. I went to this school. I went to this university. So my parents are this and that. So I am a doctor. I am a teacher, I am a lawyer, I am an administrative officer. Now we all refer all these different titles, all these different norms, and we forget that we are an administrative officer only at the office, not at home. Unfortunately, we carry that title all around and we grasp that and we become that. We become an administrative officer, we become a doctor, we become a lawyer, we become a teacher, and we forget that it's a title, it's merely a convention, it's a temporary role that we play. So likewise, there are so much of different titles, designations, names, say references given to various countries, frauds, people, etc., etc. They're full of conventions, full of terms, full of languages, full of terminologies. Now all these actually we are using just for proper communication, easy communication, so that I can communicate carefully, properly with another person. When I tell, okay, I came to the office by bus, so he has some understanding. When I refer, I came by train, okay, he has another different understanding. Okay, he understood, okay, what is the type of vehicle he used to came to the office. So it is necessary to differentiate and give a proper message, communicate proper message. So that's why all these different conventions are available. So, and we use many, many different kinds of signs for that, languages for that, words for that, vocabulary for that. But all these we consider as me, myself, belong to me, and we like it. So I love English language, I love Sinhala language. If someone challenges that, okay, I'll be in big trouble. I am going to attack him. So if someone suggests, okay, now on, I am referring this country from a different name, there may be so many people going against it. They may start rallying, they may start protesting against the new name. They want to keep the old name. They may give enough reasons. So likewise, all these different names, conventions, terminologies, and we are so attached, and we think all these belong to me, or simply this is I am. And then the fourth one, he regards formations thus: this is mine, this I am, this is myself. Now different kinds of formations are going on. So whenever a thought comes and we start fabricating on it, we start adding to it, we start thinking about it, pondering about it. So we do a lot of fabrications internally. We do a lot of further additions, subtractions, multiplications to that earlier thought. Then it becomes more and more multiplied, more and more enhanced, or more and more fabricated, formulated. Now more and more thinking. And ultimately you become angry, or ultimately you become emotional. You are crying, or you are really angry and you are shouting. Because internally there's a huge fabrication has happened. It didn't take long time, and now you are quite angry, and you refer yourself as I am angry, or I am lustful, or I am fully doubtful, I am fully confused, I am really happy, or I am fully confused. Whatever it is, the way how mind is operating with respect to various type of thinking, now we consider that state as me, myself. Say you are thinking again and again about kind of a loss has happened. Suppose due to some reason, one of your loved one has passed away. And you keep remembering him or her, and various incidents that you went through with him, various dialogues you had with him, various opportunities you had with him. So all start remembering, remembering, remembering. ultimately you start crying, you become really emotional. And we didn't understand, okay, the weaving has happened inside the mind, inside our own mind. The proliferation has happened inside our own mind. And ultimately the proliferation takes the person under it. So the person become very much like a hapless victim of the whole thing. And he is there now. He is fully engrossed with that. He is fully enveloped with that. He is fully engaged with that. He can't even come out of that. And he is referring himself with that. I'm really worried. I'm confused. I can't stop thinking. Please help me. I can't stop thinking. I can't forget him. I keep remembering him. So this is what happened to our mind. So it is now fully occupied with these kinds of conceptual proliferation, thinking. And ultimately we recognize ourselves in it, trapped in it, and we refer ourselves as that. And based upon that, there may be different wrong views can formulate. That if you can remember that there are three levels of perversions, so distortions can happen in the mind. The very early stage is the sanya vipallasa. At the very early type of grasping, the very early kind of recognizing. Say we recognize through our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. So various things we recognize. So when we recognize, we consider we have the inherent wrong perceptions that things are permanent, things are beautiful, things may provide happiness, and things internally or intrinsically are substantial. And with those wrong views or with those wrong perceptions, we start recognizing, identifying. And now we are continuing with that wrong recognition, and based upon that we start thinking. And that thinking level also, there's a distortion. Chitta vipallasa. The mind level distortion or the mind level perversion. Now, based upon the wrong data, now we start thinking. So the thinking itself is fairly established on wrong data. So our conclusions are therefore erroneous. So the conclusions are represented at the last stage. So that is the ditti vipallasa, the view level distortion, the view level perversion. So ultimately we come to a kind of a conclusion. Okay, this is it. This is like this. So this is the statement. So I am going to hold it. I am going to challenge the others. So I strongly believe this type of a view. So that whole process has went through fair amount of thinking, fair amount of formulation, fair amount of fabrication. And so we can understand, so internally, how much of fabrication has happened in our mind. It may be a little sign happened at the very early stage. But on top of that, we have done so much of multiplications, so much of fabrications, so much of additions, subtractions, this and that. And ultimately, we are suffering, we are trapped in it. We are in a fixed view, we are in a wrong view, we are in a pernicious view. And then actually so far we were very much in parallel with aggregates. Now Buddha turns it to some other area, the fifth and sixth wrong views. Here Buddha mentioned, he regards what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought, mentally pondered, thus, this is mine, this is I am, this is myself. Now, according to the commentary, this is very much referring to the fifth aggregate, that is the consciousness aggregate, where the cognition is the primary thing. So, what is seen? So, yampitang, dittang, sutam, mutang, vinyatam, pattam, pariyesitam, manasa, anuritaritam, manasa, tampi, etam mama, eso hamasmi, eso me attati. So, when we see something, we start thinking about that what we have seen. When we hear something, we start thinking what we have heard. When we sensed, that means through the nose, tongue, body, what we have sensed. With respect to that, we start thinking. And then the cognition, when a thought happened to the mind, a sign happened to the mind, we start cognizing. And based upon that, we start thinking. And what we see, probably I refer as myself. Say you are seeing your own picture, your own photograph. Suppose there is a group photo you have taken several years back at your college time, at your university time. And now you refer that. That's what you are keeping on your table. Now you refer, oh, this is I am. So he is next to me. She is next to there. So here you can see this is I am. So likewise I am referring that image as myself. And similarly, say what is heard. Say you are hearing a song and it may be beautiful. And probably now you can tell your, say, daughter to your son, okay, this is, I sang with so and so. I am the one singing that song. See how beautiful I am. How beautifully I am singing. So likewise I am referring. So I am singing. So my voice is beautiful. So all these are references that I do, either showing the claim or either showing that possessiveness or either direct identification with respect to what is seen, what is heard, and what is sensed, what is cognized. And say when you are thinking, okay, I thought it might rain today. I thought. So that's how we refer. Actually, we need to understand, I mean, these are the ways that the language was prepared. This is how it is grammatically fabricated. I mean, no problem in using it, but the problem is with the grasping it. Problem is that going beyond its limits. If we are using it within the limitations, if we are using it with the proper understanding, then there is no harm. But the problem is that we take it for granted and we think that what is referred through these languages and through these terminologies, etc., etc., are all very true. They are concrete. And we lose the purpose. Rather, we start getting into arguments, quarrels, wars, etc., etc. And then cognize encountered. So that means vinyatam pattam pariyesitam. So that means what is encountered, what came to you. And pariyesitam, what you have investigated, encountered, sought, investigated. And mentally pondered, anuicharitam manasa. So you are thinking this way, that way, you do various comparisons, rationalizing, logical thinking. All things you can refer as this is me, this is myself, this is mine. And the last one is another area where Buddha mentioned, and this standpoint for views, namely that which is the self is the world, after that I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, I shall endure as long as eternity. These two he regards thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. Now this is a strong wrong view, and he has a desire to that wrong view. And Bhikkhu Bodhi refers this with respect to the Upanishads, where he mentioned in the Upanishads, it is mentioned, so you are a small self, outside has the universal self, and you strongly believe ultimately you become one with that universal self. So that is a kind of a belief imposed by the Upanishads. So there may be religions who are imposing such kind of a view. You are being taught such kind of a view. And you probably start loving that thought. You probably start very much appreciating such kind of a teaching, and you start identifying with that teaching. Okay, I'm just the little self. Ultimately, after this death, I become fully eternal. I become one with that universal self. And you start appreciating that kind of a teaching. And you can't verify it, by the way. But you start appreciating it and you start believing it. And ultimately, you start thinking, okay, this is I am. And this is mine. This is my view. This is my religion. And the other side, Buddha mentioned that the taught noble disciple, so that is where the Buddha's teaching, so he never regards form thus. This is not mine, this is I am not, this is not myself. So that's the proper understanding that one starts having after going through a proper vipassana. Say for example, if you do Dhatu Manasikara, elements meditation, you start understanding the impermanent nature of the body. Say you do walking meditation, you do sitting meditation, you start recognizing various postures, how they are quickly changing, and you start sort of investigating the whole body, how quickly the different element characteristics appear and then disappear. So when you are continuing that type of a meditation, you can't hold a strong personality view with respect to the body. Because through your investigation, you may understand it is so fragile, it is so transient, and one state is constantly changing to another state. No state remains two moments. Everything is quite transient. So how can I understand this body as me? How can I say this body belongs to me? Because this body is constantly changing. It is not a single entity. Rather, it consists of so much of small particles or elements, and they are vulnerable beyond my control. So for such kind of a phenomena, how can I say this is me, this is myself, this belongs to me? So the practice will challenge that wrong view. So if we already had that wrong view, so as we are continuing the practice, so the practice will give us a lot of courage to challenge that wrong view. So the wrong view is slowly abandoned. The sakkayaditti is fairly abandoned as we are continuing with the practice. So similarly the Vedana. So as we are doing Vedana Anupassana, so you understand, okay, how transient these feelings are. At the beginning you may have a kind of a little understanding, okay, this pleasurable feeling arised and stayed about few minutes and then passed away. But later you might understand, okay, this is not like that. I mean, there are so much of little feelings, and the resultant I have considered as the pleasurable feeling, but internally what is available are the minute feelings, and they are quite transient. So likewise, when you get the proper understanding about the feelings, then you can't refer, okay, the feelings are me, myself, or belonging to me. Similarly, the perceptions, various signs, what you see, what you hear, various signs, various marks, colors, shapes, sounds, different pitch, different tones. So many, many different such denominations, languages, words, terms, terminologies. Now they become merely terminologies. And you understand they are not the ultimate truth. They are inherently don't have anything substantial. So likewise, as the understanding is growing, deepens, so you can't understand or you can't recognize the perceptions as me, myself, or belonging to me. So that is also now the wise person, the practitioner, is slowly abandoning. This is not me. This is not myself. And this is not mine. So that means whenever mind is trying to play the wrong old trick, so at that very moment we need to recognize it and slowly disclaim it, slowly abandon it. whenever, say, suppose you are referring an old photograph, after seeing it, immediately the me comes out, I comes out, the personality view comes out, and try to dictate it, try to delude you, telling, okay, this is I am, see how beautiful I am. So at that very moment, we need to understand, okay, again, a wrong view is coming out, a deluded thought is coming out, so I need to abandon that thought. It's a wrong thought. That thought is based upon a delusion. It is not the reality. So likewise, then and there, when the mind, the habitual tendencies are trying to promote a self, when the habitual tendencies are trying to very much like promote a self view, a personality view as an individual, then that thought has to be recognized and has to be abandoned, and therefore the Chittanupassana type of meditation has to be ongoing. So constantly we have to be vigilant. What is the kind of thought going on? Am I thinking about one of my past activity? So that comes as the fourth aggregate. Suppose you did some kind of an activity, say dana, kind of an offering. And later time you start thinking about it. So I am the one did it. I contributed this, I contributed that. So I invited the monks. So all different activities, okay, you are now start thinking. And then and there, it's affirming a self. Kind of self-affirmative thoughts are coming. Now those thoughts, we need to recognize and slowly abandon. So this is not me. This is not mine. This doesn't belong to me. This is merely a thought. This is just a memory. That activity is done. And it is not me. So likewise, we have to instruct us. We have to guide. We need to guide us. So even though we have practiced, still the habitual tendencies are operating. The asavas are still operating. Avijja, ignorance is still operating. Time to time, as thoughts, they can come out and trying to affirm a self. So at that time, we need to abandon that thought. Self-affirmative thought has to be abandoned. So likewise, Buddha continuously going to the all six wrong views and tell, so the wise person, the practitioner, is now all disclaiming that. It is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So, and later, since he is doing that, then Buddha mentions, since he regards them thus, he is not agitated about what is not existent. Since he regards them thus, he is not agitated about what is non-existent. So, evang samanupassato asati na paritasati iti. Actually, this we can further explain, discuss next week. Here, actually, is where we come to a very interesting vipassana stage. So, as you are continuing the disclaiming, as you abandon various wrong thoughts, those formations, or a kind of non-grasping state is now happening in the mind, there could be an agitation. So, this we discuss even when we were discussing the Uddesa Vibhanga Sutta. When we are slowly abandoning things, disclaiming things, our personality view can be threatened. As a result of that, fair amount of agitation can happen. But slowly, as we continue the practice, with the wisdom, probably we may be able to penetrate that wrong view. As a result of that, the agitation becomes less and less. Okay, we can discuss that later in next week a little bit in detail, because Buddha mentioned this in detail in this sutta. So with that note, I like to conclude today's sutta teaching session. Now I open the session for questions.
Thank you, Bhajan. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Yeah. So we have a question from our side.
Yes, Bhante.
Yeah.
Yes, Bhante. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you for such thorough description of these views. And it's very, this is a new teaching for me. I've never studied this sutta, so very, very alive to hear it the way you're teaching it. And thank you very much, Bhante. I was just, I wanted to check what I heard was what you were talking about on as far as formations. Sometimes I've heard that called volitional formations, and I've always thought of that as more like as being that's when we start to become active or doing something, when we see a perception, and then the formation, the volitional formation, is becoming interested and involved and wanting something. So our will becomes activated and we want to do something. And I thought it was interesting the way you were bringing that up as being our emotions get involved, and definitely a sense of self gets involved. And so the way I was seeing this was that, or hearing what you were saying, is that formations has a lot to do with becoming fixated on one's perceptions and becoming attached to what one is seeking. So we become lustful or aversive about our perceptions, and then we try to do something. We get emotionally involved and are trying to plan a way to get that thing or do things to avoid something. So is that I had it more. This was just a more thorough explanation of formations than I had ever heard. So is that correct? What I was
mentioning? I think what you refer is also correct. Yeah. Actually, this formations is a vast subject. So I mean, so what we did also is also part of the formations, because of the formations, you know, the volition.
Mm-hmm.
Volition is the strongest part in the formations. So that is where the Chetanaham Bhikkhave Kammam Vadami, Buddha mentioned, okay, the volition becomes the activity, the Kamma. So it is also a type of formation. That is the leading character, we can say, he is the leader in the formations. But there are so many other formations also, say emotions and the thoughts. All these are coming under that. Maybe wholesome thoughts, maybe unwholesome thoughts, say defilements, hindrances. So all are coming under the formations.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is very much like when a thought happened, so it may has its own inherent characteristics, but without understanding that, we start fabricating that. We start adding to that. So we start formulating on that, thinking on that. So ultimately it becomes a huge something, like a snowball, you know.
Yeah.
It's keep growing, keep adding. Ultimately it becomes a huge snowball.
Okay.
I think there's a theory like that, no? I mean,
the snowball theory.
Snowball theory. Yes. Yeah.
Something starts small, but then it grows very big. In
exactly.
Our minds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah.
And thing is, interestingly, now it is not merely the thought. I mean, what we see, also we start fabricating. So that's why Buddha mentioned when he is talking in the Kajjaniya Sutta. So very beautifully Buddha mentioned what is the Sankhara Khanda. You know, the aggregate of the formations. See, Buddha mentioned, Rupang Rupattaya Sankatang Abhisankaranti. That means, see, there are certain forms. There are certain shapes, colors, etc. into the form aggregate. And with that, we do a lot of additions, which is a lot of multiplication, to that aggregate itself. Say it's a kind of a clay, a little bit of clay we took. And there is no shape in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do a lot of additions, colors, add colors to that. And we can prepare a toy from that.
Yeah.
We can prepare a doll from that. We can prepare a lamp from that. So all these are fabrications.
Yeah.
All these are fabrication. We can make a really beautiful ornament through that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of clay. So similarly, Buddha mentioned Vedanang Vedanathaya, Sankatang Abhisankaranti. So there are a little pain. So on top of the pain, I can add so much of things. So this pain happened because of that, and he is the one who did it.
Yep.
So blah blah blah. So likewise, so on top of pain, I can do so much of different kinds of additions, subtractions, substitutions, etc. Add my own perceptions into it, likes and dislikes into it. So I just can't keep the pain as pain, isn't it? So similarly, Buddha mentioned the perceptions itself. So we do a lot of fabrications. So that's what you referred.
So we're building the formations out of the perception.
Exactly.
Making
and even the sankhara, Buddha mentioned, sankharang, sankharang, sankharathaya, sankatang, abhisankarat. Even the formations level, lustful thought comes.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that lustful thought, again we fabricate. Even angry thought comes. On top of that angry thought, we fabricate.
Mm-hmm.
So angry thought itself has that little, you know, colored nature. And we can't simply keep it as it is. We add more color to it. We add more, say, essence to it. More formulations, more fabrications, more people, more this and that to it, more politics. And that's all going and on to the typical conventions now. Now you are unhappy with the president. Now you are unhappy with the government. You are unhappy with the rebel group. So much of things are there. So likewise, so the formations aggregate is a very, you know, very active kind of a dynamic type of aggregate. Yeah, it has its own influence towards the other aggregates. So it conditions all the other aggregates. It's fabricate all the other aggregates. And it adds its own perceptions, value additions, judgments onto the other aggregates.
So formations is almost like it's the most strong of these I am things.
Mm. So that's why, I mean, now if you can understand now, say, when Buddha refers to Nibbana, so he mentioned, okay, Sabba Sankhara Samato. So you still all formations. Stilling of all formations. Stilling. Yeah, you calm down.
Yes.
You relax, you calm down all the formations. So you can see, I mean, there's a huge, or there's a fair emphasis is there onto the formations. So if you have to attain Nibbana, so you need to do that calming down process, stilling of formations.
Mm.
Allow them to pass, allow them to settle, allow them to cease, rather than you add, rather than you fabricate, rather than you formulate, you allow them to pass, you allow them to settle, you allow them to still, relax, calm. So then mind become more calm, quiet, relaxed. No tension, no additions, no colored, no formulations. So mind is settling, mind is relaxing. Now say if you consider that mainja, you know that mainja that you are preparing with little water and you add the glycerin, not glycerin, what's that?
Glitter
to that, and then you shake it and then you see how it is settling.
Yes.
So that settling part. So if we assume that it's keep on shaking, it will never settle.
Yes.
So similarly, our minds are also, we keep on shaking.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly we shake. When we see something, we shake. When we hear something, we shake. When we smell something, we shake. And even when a thought comes to the mind, still we shake. So if we are able to stop shaking, allow it to settle, allow it to pass as it is. Now, when it comes, okay, I don't do anything, any addition, any judgments. I simply allow it to pass by itself. No, there is no contribution coming from my end. I am just a gateway. Just a gateway, there is no additions. I am just allowing it to come, allowing it to pass. That's it. Then, I mean, no problem. That means, I mean, even they happen, no problem for me, because I am not disturbed. I am just remaining like a gateway. like a open gate valve. Valve doesn't add anything to the water. It's simply a valve. I mean, it's simply go through. Water simply go through. What is in is equal to what is out. Very interesting. I mean, if we can look at like that, then I mean, we can practically think, okay, what has to do in our mind? So various, the water of thoughts are coming. So our mind is like a gate valve. So it is fully open. So that water output is the thoughts are going as it is. So there is nothing remain internally. And we don't boil the water. We are not adding any color to it. We are not adding any flavor to it. It's simply going.
Thank you for further clarifying the formations. That's really great. One other thing that I noticed, which is something I had heard in the Zen teaching, was this last view of that which is the self is the world.
Mm.
And in Zen, there I heard a saying that was similar to that, but it was they said it the other way, that you could turn it around, that which is the world is actually the self. And I take that in, I'm just trying this out as a meaning that the Buddha, you know, was saying that people generally equate the world as themselves,
mm.
and they have this view of their eternal self, you know, not going to die, and it's sort of a, like owning the world as myself. But the Buddha turns it around and says, you know, see the, I think, or what I understand is that, when we contemplate the four elements, the fire, wind, earth, water elements, they're the, what is making up the entire world of physical phenomena, and our bodies are also made up of these elements. So if we see the world is, we're just ourself, the thing that we think is ourself is really just no more than these elements.
Mm.
So
mm-hmm.
it's not personal, it's not something we own.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like turning it around and saying, you know, the world is actually, we're a part of the world, but we're not, because of that, we don't own ourselves.
Mm. We can argue telling, okay, we are part of the world.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that the world is self.
We're a part of the world, yes.
We can say, I mean, the bodies, our body especially, the physical body, we can say it belongs to the nature. It belongs to the world, to the physical world.
Mm.
And once it dies, it may perish to the earth. We can say so. I mean, that is, I can't see any wrong telling so. But the problem is, if we are referring a big self to the world, so that is where we go wrong. So I am a little self. The body is my little self. And after my passing away, that little self become merged with the large self. That's the world. So people start believing that. I mean, people can have such kind of a wrong view, and they love that. Because internally, as a one self, I am weak. Ultimately, I become the huge. I become one with it. So my Godfather, I am becoming the, I am little child of the Godfather, and I am ultimately after death I become be with him. I am quite eternally happy with him.
Yes.
So that's
very comforting.
Very comforting.
Like,
exactly.
Yes.
I love that kind of a thought, isn't it? So because assume that today I am suffering and I am going through a lot of disasters and calamities and problems, but I have a kind of a refuge in the Godfather. Thinking, okay, I'm nothing to worry, I just have to bear only a couple of years. After my death, I'm going to be with him, then I become merged with the self. So I'm eternally happy. So I may really love such kind of a comforting view. So that comforting view, then I start recognizing, okay, this is I am. So this is myself. So that is what Buddha denied here. So even such kind of a wrong, such kind of a view is a wrong view. You can't have, there is no such kind of a everlasting entity at all. Neither in the personal level, neither in the physical level, nor in the outside external level. So that sense, if you can see, what's the type of correct view in that sense? Buddha is talking, isn't it? You can see how carefully Buddha is teaching his teaching, without getting to any kind of extreme, without going to any kind of an annihilation, and without going to any kind of an eternalism. He's denying both. He's not going to attract or not going to sort of lean on to any of these extremes, nor to the annihilation, nor to the eternalism. And he's going to tell, okay, this is because of this that exists. So this is the kind of dependently arisen path, the teaching that he's telling. So without taking any of the extremes, I am telling the Dhamma with middle path in the Majjhe Sutta, or rather in the Kacchanagotta Sutta, Buddha mentioned. So without taking any of these extremes, not thinking that the world is eternal, existing, everything exists, or not taking the wrong view, everything does not exist, without taking any of these wrong views, I am teaching the Dhamma in the middle way, because of this that exists, when this doesn't exist, that does not exist. It's a complete conditionality, kind of a dependent origination, that he is now preaching the Dhamma. So it's very interesting, actually. Probably we can continue our discussion maybe at the end of this sutta, thinking about taking that Kacchanagotta Sutta, where a fair amount of the proper correct view is highlighted.
Yeah. And I guess what I was pointing to was partly too is that when we meditate, we can actually experience the actual elements.
Mm.
We can experience heat.
Exactly.
So we can verify that we are made up of heat, we are made up of solidity, and so forth. So this is verifiable, whereas if we say, I'm part of the eternal, God, the world.
Can't verify.
It cannot verify.
Cannot verify, yes.
So
yes.
It keeps us closer to reality.
Mm. Yeah.
Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah. Okay, Jennifer, we finished our side.
Okay, thank you, Bhante. I do have a email question. There's two parts. Let me copy and paste this because it's quite long, so you have it in your chat as well. Okay, it says, respected Bhante, when relating to the aggregate and also when relating to dependent origination, is it correct to translate vijnana with sense consciousness? This to mark the difference to other usages of the word vijnana, for example, unestablished or invisible or non-resisting, anidasana or apatigam, consciousness or universal consciousness, etc. That's part one of the question.
Yeah. Actually, now when we are considering apatittita vijnana, that is unestablished consciousness, and anidasana vijnana, we can say the unmanifested consciousness. So these are actually, we can't say, are the conditioned phenomena. So we don't need to confuse this with the typical vijnana. So typical vijnana is something constantly arising and passing away, and they are very much dependently arisen. And the thing is that depends on the fair amount of nama rupa, name and form. So the consciousness is constantly entangled with name and form, and it has been deluded by the ignorance, and as a result of that ignorance, it is constantly being deluded by name and form. So therefore, it's constantly going as a duet, Name and form coupled with consciousness. Name and form coupled with consciousness. There's an interrelationship between name and form and the consciousness, vinyana and nama rupa. And that is the kind of the whirlpool that Buddha is talking, and very well explained by Most Venerable Katukurunda Jnanananda Bhante. So it's a kind of a whirlpool, constantly going on and on. Now, suppose that whirlpool ultimately becomes nothing. Assume that there was a whirlpool, that whirlpool ultimately calms down. And when that whirlpool calms down, so where can I say that whirlpool exists? So we can't say, I mean, that is a kind of a whirlpool, kind of a phenomena, which was available due to the currents. But ultimately everything now settled. Now it's just the ocean is available now. Maybe some amount of debris absorbed during the time of the whirlpool is now simply circulating, simply floating. And to that we can probably refer, okay, that was where the whirlpool was. But other than that, there is no whirlpool right now. So therefore, when one attains the full enlightenment, so that is what Buddha mentioned, so there is no whirlpool right now. And what you refer as an arahant are merely that debris which was absorbed during the operation of the whirlpool. But now there is no whirlpool right now. So slowly, when the arahant passed away, he comes to the final parinibbana, even that debris has gone. His body as a debris also has gone. So nothing is there. So likewise, when we are referring anidassana vinyana, appatitthita vinyana, so we don't need to refer it with respect to the conditioned world. So that is very much like all the fabrications are stopped. All the graspings are abandoned. Now mind is going through a state where there is no grasping. And as a result of that, there is no any name and form. There is no any avijja, ignorance. At least for a limited time, there is no ignorance operating. And as a result of that, that whirlpool is, at least for a moment, ceased, calmed down. So that is the state Buddha refers as the state of anidassana vinyana or the appatitthita vinyana. So where you can't refer where you are. You can't refer you as a self. You can't refer you as an identity. So such kind of a self-view is absent in such state. So that is the state with respect to consciousness Buddha refer as the anidassana vinyana or the appatitthita vinyana.
Practically speaking, how do I experience the difference? What comes first? Mm-hmm. Can sanya occur without vinyana? Respectively, can vinyana happen without sanya? Thank you, Bhante.
Yeah, very interesting. Actually, the sanya with respect to sounds. Now, say when I am talking, you can understand, okay, the monk is talking, the Bhante is talking. When Jennifer is talking, okay, we can refer, okay, Jennifer is talking. So there is a difference through the tone, through the way we talk. There are little marks, signs using which we know, okay, this is Bhante is talking or this is Jennifer is talking. So likewise, with respect to the sound, so there are little differences, there are little tones, frequencies, using which we can differentiate who is the person talking. So likewise, with respect to sounds, there are little such marks, frequencies, tones, this and that, so using which we can differentiate. So those are the signs which comes under the available in the sounds itself. And the differentiative characteristic, the differentiative ability is also part of the vinyana, the consciousness. And the consciousness is the one telling, okay, this is Bhante is talking, this is Jennifer is talking. So it now has completely divided into two. So it is a fair involvement is there at the latter stage in the consciousness. So it differentiate. So different sound, the qualities or different characteristics, different sounds, marks are available in the sound. And using those, actually those characteristics are belonging to the perceptions aggregate, we can say. And the initial recognition happen, using which also belonging to the perception aggregate. And later, I do further differentiation, okay, this is a male voice, this is a female voice, this is this, this is that, and this is the word, this word means that. So likewise, all these more further understanding happens at the cognition level. We can attribute that to the consciousness aggregate.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, Bhante. What I have to ask is not related to today's discussion. Is that okay?
Yeah, fine. Since we don't have further questions, we can go ahead.
I have been listening to some Abhidhamma, Bhikkhu Bodhis, and another monk, and in it says that the Chuttisitta is then the Pratisandhisitta. They comes, you know, so one after another.
Mm.
But some places, some monks have been talking about after you have the after you die, Chuttisitta, you float around until you find a suitable place to take birth.
Mm.
Sort of like a thunderbird.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get reborn.
Mm-hmm.
Which is correct. I'm not quite... I don't understand it, because I always used to think that birth takes place just like a kudela, or what is that?
Leech.
What do you call it?
Leech.
Leech.
Yeah.
Like that. If you give up one place, you hold on to the other one right away.
Mm-hmm.
So, which one is correct? And is there a thing called this Gandhava?
No, that's the thing. I mean, so according to the Theravada the tradition, teaching, we don't believe in that Gandhava state. There is no intermediate state. So immediately after the passing away, the birth happens at the next place, at the next moment, at the next life. So even if one is talking about a Gandhava state, so that is another intermediate life, we can say. Say for example, say you have a lot of merits and you passed away here, and you are and the merit has the capacity to be born as a deva, but there may be a transient. So there may be a transient, little short life also probably. After that passing away of that short life, okay, you can become the deva as well. So that short life itself is having the prasidhanda chitta and go through a little bit of thinking and all sort of things, and then maybe after a couple of days, so that life ends, and now you get into the next life. So therefore, there is no any gap.
So yes, that makes sense to me, because if there is, then that means that consciousness is living by itself.
No. We can't say like that either. So okay. Consciousness by itself is wrong view. So consciousness,
yes,
is also dependent. It's also arising and passing away. It's a stream of consciousness. We can say it's
right.
A continuously arising and passing away due to causes and conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then, what are the point I was trying to make is this: that if as you say, there is a short life, birth taken place, short span of life, then I can understand it.
Hmm.
But if you were to have somebody floating, you know,
without
a taking form, then it is just the consciousness.
No.
No?
No.
But,
There is there is no such consciousness floating. So that is something denied. I mean, even if it is an arupavachara realm, it is not merely consciousness. It's all the other, except the form aggregate, all the other aggregates are present, even in the arupavachara realm.
Right.
That is also arising and passing away.
Right.
Yeah.
So in other words, you're saying that short life is also a life form.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. That makes it.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's very good to you.
Okay, thank you. I'll return that to Debbie for the next question.
Thank you, Jennifer. Just following that previous question, Bhante.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Buddhists give a 1 week dana and all because they say that it's a restless, some kind of restless consciousness is moving around. Isn't that why they give the 1 week dana?
We can't say so. We can't say that every day, every time such thing is available. But there may be certain situations where the person is reborn as a hungry ghost or a peta realm. So there's a possibility that he or she is expecting some merit. So other than that, we can't have a fixed view telling that everybody is going through such kind of an intermediate life. And that is wandering for 7 days, and then only they come to another birth. That's a wrong view.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they are just another sort of another form, and then they go in after that 1 week. Maybe they go into a more stable form. Would that be a correct interpretation?
Not to everyone. That's also one possibility.
No, some people.
Yeah, that's just one possibility. And there are only, you know, even among the other beings, only one type of people, or we can say beings, are capable of benefiting from that merit. But others may rejoice from that, but can't really get the, benefit like taking that use. Because of that merit, they are capable of getting another proper birth or more advanced birth. Others can simply appreciate that. Now say for example, Venerable, so this Anathapindika, the Gahapati. So he simply passed away and he became a Deva. And there was no intermediate life. So today, say for example, today Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Ananda, and they all gone to this Anathapindika while he was going through the deathbed, the suffering, and they preached Dhamma. Okay, next morning, another Pindika appear in front of the Buddha and praising Venerable Sariputta and appreciating Buddha and praising the Buddha and the Sangha. So immediately he was born in the heavenly realm.
So anyway, that's just a thing. The other question what I wanted to clarify was that you spoke about mental formations or volitional formations.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that is the intention. That is our intention, which is called the mental formation or volitional formation. Is that right?
Yeah, intention is the most prominent formation.
Yes, and then the emotions and thoughts and ideas and all stem from that.
Yeah, we can say so. We can say they either stem from that or they support that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the actual verbal action or physical action is related to that, but you wouldn't call that formations, would you?
We can. That's why kaya. Mano sanchetana, kaya, samachara. So likewise, certain terminology is used. Bodily formations, mental formations, verbal formations. Now say when I am talking. So there are a certain amount of, internal thought formations have happened. Accordingly, I am talking. So it may happen very quickly. So the output is the word, the sound. So this sound is thought and then fabricated and communicated. It is not I am just making a sound, rather so all the formulations have happened internally, and then the proper sound, proper word, proper tone, etc. is represented.
So if somebody gets angry and hits somebody, that is a physical action.
Correct.
Would you call that also formation?
Yes, that's a body deformation.
So they are all volitional formation or mental formation?
Yeah, that's why I mean in the sankhara, kaya sankhara, vachi sankhara, chitta sankhara, now they all contribute to the karma.
Yes.
So anyway, if it is intentional, it can contribute to the karma.
So what you're telling me is all things that contribute to karma are called formation, mental or volitional formation. Am I getting that right?
That is one part. That's why the formation subject is very vast. So Buddha mentioned there are certain type of formations which doesn't contribute to the karma as well. So they are called asampajana kaya sankhara. So they happen naturally due to various other causes, and you are not intentionally making them. Now say for example the breathing. Either you can intentionally breathe, and either without your intention the body breathes.
Yes.
So during the sleeping time. So there is no your participation, there is no intention to breathe, but body breathes. So that is also a formation, a bodily formation. At that level, it's a asampajana. So there is no your participation, there is no intention. So therefore, in the Kaya Sutta, Buddha mentioned, so these formations are possible to occur either because of your own internal persuasion, your own internal deliberate intention, or because of someone else's participation, or without any of those external contribution, the formations can happen.
Yes, so what I'm hearing is those verbal and physical actions which are intentional, which we have intended to do, those cause karma, and
correct,
those are also part of the formations. But
correct,
there are some which are not related, we are not having an intention, and they are automatically or whatever you want to call it, happening. So then they don't form karma, is that right?
Correct.
Yes, and therefore they are not formation. They are not
contributing to the karma.
They are not formation.
They are not contributing
to
karma.
Karma. Okay. So it's a bit complicated, but
that's why the formations aggregate is fairly having a vast subject.
Yes. So we keep it simple by saying it's intentional, but also related to that intention, if we have verbal or physical actions, that is also formations and contribute to karma.
Correct.
Keep it like that. That's simple enough, right?
Correct.
Okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank
you very much, Pante.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to invite Sam for the next question.
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. Pante, my question relates to what you just mentioned about Gandharva state. I read a piece written by Bhikkhu Bodhi just a few days ago. He wrote it in 2014. I came across just a few days ago.
Right.
Relates to Dhammaruan's story. You probably know the story, right?
Yes.
Dhammaruan, who was born, like when he was about 2 to 4 years old, he started reciting all these complex suttas with a totally different style.
Correct.
With a nice melody. So, Bodhi mentions that he, after his... the storyline is that he was a monk during Buddha Ghosha's, Venerable Buddha Ghosha's time, and that he recited these suttas over and over again during that time.
Mm-hmm.
and he had a memory of that, and that's how he was able to recite those sutras, very complex sutras like Nirmanatha Sutta, Bhojanga Sutta, Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, etc., in that style when he was a young child.
Correct.
And Bhikkhu Bodhi apparently interviewed him in 2014, and he said that between his time during Buddha Ghosha's time and his birth this time, I think he was born in 1960s or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was living in a Gandhabha state, and Bhikkhu Bodhi says it's like Manomaya Kaya.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very interested that how could one live 1500 years. I think Buddha Ghosha was around 500 AD. So I was very interested in that. I can forward that link to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have your email address, but if I can find your email address, I can forward that link to you. It's very, very interesting.
Uh-huh.
Reading about it. And the other part I want to tell you is that I met Dharma Ruan in California.
Mm-hmm.
about 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And he conducted a one-day meditation retreat close to where I live. So after the Dharma talk, I asked him of his background, and he told me, he confirmed that he was a bhikkhu during Buddha Ghosha's time, and he was among 500 bhikkhus, and he said that he had to remember, he and the other bhikkhus had to remember certain number of sutras, and they had to recite them daily.
Mm-hmm.
So that they remembered them, because at that time apparently they probably didn't have any writing media.
Correct.
So I asked him whether he remembers the sutras now. He said it comes on and off.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't remember. It's like when it comes, he can recite.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody asks him, can you recite this sutra now, he cannot do that.
Correct.
And even if he recites, it's the modern style.
Mm.
Not the old style he was reciting when he was 2 to 4 years old.
Right.
So my question to you is, I'm very confused about Bhikkhu Bodhi's explanation that one could live 1500 years in a Gandhabha state, which he says he was living with a Manomaya Kaya.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
No, I can't believe that. Basically, I think that maybe 1500 years he may be born as a deva or some other another character, another being, not as a human being. Now he has born as a human being, but in between that time period he may be another being, not a kind of a trans kind of what you call Gandhabha or something like that. Definitely be another person, another being.
I mean, I thought exactly the same way that you thought.
Yeah.
But the question is, you said Gandhabha is not in Theravada tradition, right? But
correct.
Bhikkhu Bodhi is a Theravada bhikkhu, right?
Yes. And even, you know, there are certain other monks in the Theravada tradition. Can't remember his name. So he was he's a Sri Lankan monk, a very scholar monk. He also started talking about the Gandhabha state, and these are very much like now become quite complicated because these theories are coming from Mahayana or something, and then some monks are talking at the Theravada tradition also, and now things are fairly becoming complicated and mixed up. So, but anyway, I mean, what we need to understand is these things does not much contribute to our practice. When these are good for our speculation, but not much contributing to our practice, because we don't know. I mean, we don't need to wait till we die to verify what's either the Gandhabha state available or the next life is immediately going to happen, because that understanding doesn't much contribute to our practice. So the practice is the most important thing. So that is what we need to pay more attention.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Kumudin, do you have another question? I see your hand is raised.
I have a very small question, please. If you have time, Bhante.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to find out from you, you know, when we Sri Lankan Buddhists give Dane once every year for in the memory of
they are mere conventions. You know, now the when a religion is practiced for a long time by a particular nation, so it becomes a kind of a tradition. It mixed up with the culture, and ultimately they don't understand what's the purpose and everything, but they simply do it because it is a tradition. So doing Dane once a year and everything is just a kind of a cultural tradition nowadays available.
So if I find it difficult to perform that living in a foreign country, I shouldn't feel bad about it, right?
I mean you don't need to wait 1 year, you can do it at another time also. I mean, this is just a kind of a convenient memorization, or rather kind of a reminder. Okay, now I have to, you know, do some merit to my passed away relatives, my passed away parents. You know, that's a kind of a comforting reminder, so that people can do that, get together and do that as an activity. So other than that, there is no time limit to give merit. So you can, even after a person passed away, you can give merit. And any other day you can give merit. And you don't need to wait for 7 days. You don't need to wait for 1 year. So they are mere conventions.
Thank you, Bhante. Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, then we'll wind up today's sessions. So we have spent about 1.5 hours. And all the merits that we have accumulated, we'll share with all the past relatives, with all the celestial beings and whoever in need of merits. And we wish these merits help us also to attain path, fruition, Nibbana. While keeping these good wishes in our mind, let's recite the traditional verses. Ettavata ca amhehi sambhataṁ punya sampadam sabbe deva numodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Ettavata ca amhehi sambhataṁ punya sampadam sabbe bhuta numodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Ettavata ca amhehi sambhataṁ punya sampadam sabbe satta numodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Akasattha ca bhummattha devanaga mahiddhika punyantam anumoditva chiraṁ rakkhantu sasanam. Satta ca bhummattha devanaga mahiddhika punyantam anumoditva chiraṁ rakkhantu desanam. Akasattha ca bhummattha devanaga mahiddhika punyantam anumoditva chiraṁ rakkhantu mam param. Idam vo ñātīnaṁ hotu sukhitā huntu ñātayo. Idam vo ñātīnaṁ hotu sukhitā huntu ñātayo. Idam vo ñātīnaṁ hotu sukhitā huntu ñātayo. Imina punya kammena māme bāla samāgamo. Satam samāgamo hotu yāva nibbāna pattiyā. Imina punya kammena māme bāla samāgamo. Satam samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Imina punya kammena mame bala samagamo. Satam samagamo hotu yava nibbana pattiya. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you, Bhante. Teruvan sannai.
Yeah, teruvan sannai.